The Mystery of the Blue Train, Agatha Christie. Chapter 30. Miss Viner Gives Judgment. Catherine looked out of Miss Viner's bedroom window. It was raining, not violently, but with a quiet, well-bred persistence. The window looked out on a strip of front garden with a path down to the gate and neat little flower beds on either side, where later roses and pinks and blue hyacinths would bloom. Miss Viner was lying in a large Victorian bedstead. A tray with the remains of breakfast had been pushed to one side, and she was busy opening her correspondence and making various caustic comments upon it. Catherine had an open letter in her hand and was reading it through for the second time. It was dated from the Ritz Hotel, Paris. "Cher Mademoiselle Catherine," it began, "I trust that you are in good health, and that the return to the English winter has not proved too depressing. Me, I prosecute my inquiries with the utmost diligence. Do not think that it is the holiday that I take here. Very shortly I shall be in England, and I hope then to have the pleasure of meeting you once more. It shall be so, shall it not? On arrival in London I shall write to you. You remember that we are colleagues in this affair. But indeed, I think you know that very well. Be assured, mademoiselle, of my most respectful and devoted sentiments. Hercule Poirot." Catherine frowned slightly. It was as though something in the letter puzzled and intrigued her. "A choir boy's picnic indeed," came from Miss Viner. "Tommy Saunders and Albert Dykes ought to be left behind, and I shan't subscribe to it unless they are. What those two boys think they're doing in church on Sundays, I don't know. Tommy sang, 'O God, make speed to save us,' and never opened his lips again. And if Albert Dykes wasn't sucking a mint humbug, my nose is not what it is and always has been." "I know, they're awful," agreed Catherine. She opened her second letter, and a sudden flush came to her cheeks. Miss Viner's voice in the room seemed to recede into the far distance. When she came back to a sense of her surroundings, Miss Viner was bringing a long speech to a triumphant termination. "And I said to her, 'Not at all. As it happens, Miss Gray is Lady Tamplin's own cousin. What do you think of that?' 'Were you fighting my battles for me? That was very sweet of you.' 'You can put it that way if you like. There's nothing to me in a title. Vicar's wife or no vicar's wife, that woman is a cat. Hinting that you bought your way into society.'" Perhaps she was not so very far wrong. "And look at you," continued Miss Viner. "Have you come back a stuck-up fine lady, as well you might have done? No, there you are, as sensible as ever you were, with a pair of good Balbriggan stockings on and your sensible shoes. I spoke to Ellen about it only yesterday. 'Ellen,' I said, 'you look at Miss Gray. She's been hobnobbing with some of the greatest in the land, and does she go about as you do with skirts up to her knees and silk stockings that ladder when you look at them, and the most ridiculous shoes that ever I set eyes on?'" Catherine smiled a little to herself. It had apparently been worthwhile to conform to Miss Viner's prejudices. The old lady went on with increasing gusto. "It's been a great relief to me that you've not had your head turned. Only the other day I was looking for my cuttings. I have several about Lady Tamplin and her war hospital and whatnot, but I can't lay my hand upon them. I wish you'd look, my dear. Your eyesight's better than mine. They're in a box in the bureau drawer." Catherine glanced down at the letter in her hand and was about to speak, but checked herself, and going over to the bureau, found the box of cuttings and began to look over them. Since her return to St. Mary Mead, her heart had gone out to Miss Viner in admiration of the old woman's stoicism and pluck. She felt that there was little she could do for her old friend, but she knew from experience how much those seemingly small trifles meant to old people. "Here's one," she said presently. "Viscountess Tamplin, who is running her villa at Nice as an officer's hospital, has just been the victim of a sensational robbery, her jewels having been stolen. Amongst them were some very famous emeralds, heirlooms of the Tamplin family." "Probably paste," said Miss Viner. "A lot of these society women's jewels are." "Here's another," said Catherine, "a picture of her. A charming camera study of Viscountess Tamplin with her little daughter Lennox." "Let me look," said Miss Viner. "You can't see much of the child's face, can you? But I dare say that it's just as well. Things go by contraries in this world, and beautiful mothers have hideous children. I dare say the photographer realized that to take the back of the child's head was the best thing he could do for her." Catherine laughed. "One of the smartest hostesses on the Riviera this season is Viscountess Tamplin, who has a villa at Cap Martin. Her cousin, Miss Gray, who recently inherited a vast fortune in a most romantic manner, is staying with her there." "That's the one I wanted," said Miss Viner. "I expect there's been a picture of you in one of the papers that I've missed. You know the kind of thing. Mrs. Somebody or Other Jones-Williams, at the something or other point to point, usually carrying a shooting stick and having one foot lifted up in the air. It must be a trial to some of them to see what they look like." Catherine didn't answer. She was smoothing out the cutting with her finger, and her face had a puzzled, worried look. Then she drew the second letter out of its envelope and mastered its contents once more. She turned to her friend. "Miss Viner, I wonder, there's a friend of mine, someone I met on the Riviera, who wants very much to come down and see me here."
"A man?" said Miss Viner.
"Yes."
"Who is he?"
"He is secretary to Mr. Fenalden, the American millionaire."
"What's his name?"
"Knighton, Major Knighton."
Secretary to a millionaire, and wants to come down here. Now, Catherine, I'm going to say something to you for your own good. You're a nice girl, and a sensible girl, and though you have your head screwed on the right way about most things, every woman makes a fool of herself once in her life. 10 to 1 that this man is after your money." With a gesture, she arrested Catherine's reply. "I've been waiting for something of this kind. What is a secretary to a millionaire? 9 times out of 10, it's a young man who likes living soft. A young man with nice manners and a taste for luxury and no brains and no enterprise. And if there's anything that is a softer job than being secretary to a millionaire, it's marrying a rich woman for her money. I'm not saying that you might not be some man's fancy, but you're not young. And though you have a very good complexion, you're not a beauty. And what I say to you is, don't make a fool of yourself. But if you're determined to do so, do see that your money's properly tied up on yourself. There, now I've finished. What have you got to say?"
"Nothing," said Catherine. "But would you mind if he did come down to see me?"
"I wash my hands of it," said Miss Viner. "I've done my duty, and whatever happens now is on your head. Would you like him to lunch or to dinner?"
"I dare say Ellen could manage dinner. That is, if she didn't lose her head."
"Lunch would be very nice," said Catherine. "It is awfully kind of you, Miss Viner. He asked me to ring him up, so I'll do so and say that we shall be pleased if he will lunch with us. He'll motor down from town."
"Ellen does a steak with grilled tomatoes pretty fairly," said Miss Viner. "She doesn't do it well, but she does it better than anything else. It's no good having a tart because she's heavy-handed with pastry, but her little castle puddings are not bad, and I dare say you could find a nice piece of Stilton at Abbott's. I've always heard that gentlemen like a nice piece of Stilton, and there's a good deal of father's wine left, a bottle of sparkling Moselle, perhaps."
"Oh, no, Miss Viner, that's not really necessary."
"Nonsense, my child. No gentleman is happy unless he drinks something with his meal. There's some good pre-war whiskey if you think he'd prefer that. Now, do as I say, and don't argue. The key of the wine cellar is in the 3rd drawer down in the dressing table, in the 2nd pair of stockings on the left-hand side."
Catherine went obediently to the spot indicated.
"The 2nd pair now, mine," said Miss Viner. "The 1st pair's my diamond earrings and my filigree brooch in it."
"Oh," said Catherine, rather taken aback. "Wouldn't you like them put in your jewel case?"
Miss Viner gave vent to a terrific and prolonged snort.
"No, indeed. I have much too much sense for that sort of thing, thank you. Dear, dear, I well remember how my poor father had a safe built in downstairs. Pleased as punch he was with it, and he said to my mother, 'Now, Mary, you bring me your jewels in their case every night, and I'll lock them away for you.' My mother was a very tactful woman, and she knew that gentlemen like having their own way, and she brought him the jewel case to be locked up, just as he said. And one night, burglars broke in, and of course, naturally, the first thing they went for was the safe. It would be, with my father talking up and down the village and bragging about it until you might have thought he kept all King Solomon's diamonds there. They made a clean sweep, got the tankards, the silver cups, and the presentation gold plate that my father had had present to him, and the jewel case. She sighed reminiscently. My father was in a great state over my mother's jewels. There was the Venetian set, and some very fine cameos, and some pale pink corals, and two diamond rings with quite large stones in them. And then, of course, she had to tell him that being a sensible woman, she had kept her jewelry rolled up in a pair of corsets, and there it was, still as safe as anything. And the jewel case had been quite empty? Oh, no, dear, said Miss Viner. It would have been too light a weight then. My mother was a very intelligent woman. She saw to that. She kept her buttons in the jewel case, and a very handy place it was. Boot buttons in the top tray, trouser buttons in the second tray, and assorted buttons below. Curiously enough, my father was quite annoyed with her. He said he didn't like deceit. But I mustn't go chattering on. You want to go and ring up your friend, and mind you, choose a nice piece of steak, and tell Ellen she's not to have holes in her stockings when she waits at lunch. Is her name Ellen or Helen, Miss Viner? I thought... Miss Viner closed her eyes. I can sound my H's, dear, as well as anyone, but Helen is not a suitable name for a servant. I don't know what the mothers in the lower classes are coming to nowadays. The rain had cleared away when Knighton arrived at the cottage. The pale, fitful sunshine shone down on it and burnished Catherine's head as she stood in the doorway to welcome him. He came up to her quickly, almost boyishly. I say, I hope you don't mind. I simply had to see you again. I hope the friend you're staying with doesn't mind. Come in and make friends with her, said Catherine. She can be most alarming, but you'll soon find that she has the softest heart in the world. Miss Viner was enthroned majestically in the drawing room, wearing a complete set of the cameos which had been so providentially preserved in the family. She greeted Knighton with dignity and an austere politeness which would have damped many men. Knighton, however, had a charm of manner which was not easily set aside, and after about 10 minutes, Miss Viner thawed perceptibly. Luncheon was a merry meal, and Ellen, or Helen, in a new pair of silk stockings devoid of ladders, performed prodigies of waiting. Afterwards, Catherine and Knighton went for a walk, and they came back to have a tea tête-à-tête, since Miss Viner had gone to lie down. When the car had finally driven off, Catherine went slowly upstairs. A voice called her, and she went into Miss Viner's bedroom. Friend gone? Yes. Thank you so much for letting me ask him down. No need to thank me. Do you think I'm a sort of old curmudgeon who never will do anything for anybody? I think you're a dear, said Catherine affectionately. Humph, said Miss Viner, mollified. As Catherine was leaving the room, she called her back. Catherine? Yes? I was wrong about that young man of yours. A man, when he's making up to anybody, can be cordial and gallant and full of little attentions and altogether charming. But when a man is really in love, he can't help looking like a sheep. Now, whenever that young man looked at you, he looked like a sheep. I take back all I said this morning. It is genuine. Chapter 31. Mr. Aaron's Lunches. Ah, said Mr. Joseph Aaron, appreciatively. He took a long draught from his tankard, set it down with a sigh, wiped the froth from his lips, and beamed across the table at his host, Monsieur Hercule Poirot. Give me, said Mr. Aaron. Give me, said Mr. Aaron, a good porterhouse steak in a tankard of something worth drinking, and anyone can have your French falals and whatnots, your hors d'oeuvres and your omelettes and your little bits of quail. Give me, he reiterated, a porterhouse steak. Poirot, who had just complied with this request, smiled sympathetically. "Not that there's much wrong with a steak and kidney pudding," continued Mr. Ahrens. "Apple tart? Yes, I'll take apple tart, thank you, miss, and a jug of cream." The meal proceeded. Finally, with a long sigh, Mr. Ahrens laid down his spoon and fork, preparatory to toying with some cheese, before turning his mind to other matters. "There was a little matter of business, I think you said, Monsieur Poirot," he remarked. "Anything I can do to help you, I am sure I shall be most happy." "That's very kind of you," said Poirot. "I said to myself, if you want to know anything about the dramatic profession, there's one person who knows all that is to be known, and that is my old friend, Mr. Joseph Ahrens." "And you don't say far wrong," said Mr. Ahrens complacently. "Whether it is past, present, or future, Joe Ahrens is the man to come to."
"Précisément. Now I want to ask you, Mr. Ahrens, what you know about a young woman called Kid."
"Kid? Kitty Kid?"
"Kitty Kid. Pretty smart she was. Male impersonator, song and a dance. That one?"
"That's the one."
"Very smart she was. Made a good income, never out of an engagement. Male impersonation mostly, but as a matter of fact, you could not touch her as a character actress."
"So I have heard," said Poirot. "But she's not been appearing lately, has she?"
"No, dropped right out of things. Went over to France and took up with some swell nobleman there. She quitted the stage then, for good and all, I guess."
"How long ago was that?"
"Let me see. 3 years ago. And she's been a loss, let me tell you that. She was clever. Clever as a cartload of monkeys. You don't know the name of the man she became friends with in Paris."
"He was a swell, I know that. A count, or was it a marquis? Now I come to think of it, I believe it was a marquis."
"And you know nothing about her since?"
"Nothing. Never even run across her accidentally, like. I bet she's tooling it round some of these foreign resorts, being a marquise to the life. You couldn't put one over on Kitty. She'd give as good as she got any day."
"I see," said Poirot thoughtfully.
"I'm sorry I can't tell you more, Monsieur Poirot," said the other. "I'd like to be of use to you if I could. You did me a good turn once."
"Ah, but we're quits on that. You too did me a good turn."
"One good turn deserves another, ha ha," said Mr. Ahrens.
"Your profession must be a very interesting one," said Poirot.
So, said Mr. Ahrens noncommittally. "Taking the rough with the smooth, it's all right. I don't do so badly at it, all things considered. But you have to keep your eyes skinned. Never know when the public will jump for next."
"Dancing has come very much to the fore in the last few years," murmured Poirot reflectively.
"I never saw anything in this Russian ballet, but people like it. Too highbrow for me. I met one dancer out on the Riviera, Mademoiselle Morel."
"Morel? She's hot stuff by all accounts. There's always money going to back her, though so far as she goes, the girl can dance. I've seen her, and I know what I'm talking about. I never had much to do with her myself, but I hear she's a terror to deal with. Tempers and tantrums all the time."
"Yes," said Poirot thoughtfully. "Yes, so I should imagine."
"Temperament," said Mr. Ahrens. "Temperament. That's what they call it themselves. My missus was a dancer before she married me, but I am thankful to say she never had any temperament. You don't want temperament in the house, Monsieur Poirot."
"I agree with you, my friend. It is out of place there."
"A woman should be calm and sympathetic and a good cook," said Mr. Ahrens.
"Morel has not been long before the public, has she?" asked Poirot.
"About 2.5 years, that's all," said Mr. Ahrens. "Some French duke started her. I hear now that she's taken up with the ex-prime minister of Greece. These are the chaps who managed to put money away quietly."
"That's news to me," said Poirot.
"Oh, she's not one to let the grass grow under her feet. They say that young Kettering murdered his wife on her account. I don't know, I'm sure. Anyway, he's in prison, and she had to look round for herself, and pretty smart she's been about it. They say she's wearing a ruby the size of a pigeon's egg. Not that I have ever seen a pigeon's egg myself, but that's what they always call it in works of fiction."
"A ruby the size of a pigeon's egg," said Poirot.
His eyes were green and cat-like. How interesting!
I had it from a friend of mine, said Mr. Ahrens. But for all I know, it may be colored glass. They're all the same, these women. They never stop telling tall stories about their jewels. Morel goes about bragging that it has got a curse on it. Heart of fire, I think she calls it.
But if I remember rightly, said Poirot, the ruby that is named Heart of Fire is the center stone in a necklace.
There you are. Didn't I tell you there's no end to the lies women will tell about their jewelry? This is a single stone, hung on a platinum chain round her neck. But as I said before, 10 to 1, it's a bit of colored glass.
No, said Poirot gently. No. Somehow I don't think it is colored glass.